So let's generate our motivation. And let's begin by thinking of the value and the benefit that comes from humility. This is quite opposite to our Western culture. But when you think of wanting to progress on the Dharma path, it's got to be founded on appreciation, gratitude, humility, earnestness. It's not founded upon demands, obligations. And so to make our mind soft, to make our mind appreciative, is quite important, because that way we can listen and really benefit from the teachings. If we're full of ourselves, very little Dharma can actually go in. And so that's why it's good before teachings to reflect on the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, because doing so grows a feeling of appreciation, respect, humility. And that makes our mind receptive to the Dharma. And so seeing ourself as the lowest of all, as it says in the thought training teachings, can have that effect of opening us up so that we can really soak in what all there is to learn. So with that kind of attitude towards both the Triple Gem and towards sentient beings, then let's generate the altruistic intention and share the teachings this evening. When Venerable Dhamma and I were at His Holiness's teachings, not so long ago, but it was on the other half of other side of the world, so it feels like a long time ago. We had the fortune of sitting on the stage right below His Holiness's throne, and the Korean monks and nuns were sitting on the stage, a group of Theravada monks, and Vietnamese monks and nuns were also on the stage. And one time, there was one, I forget if he was Korean or Vietnamese, monk was standing beneath a large Buddha statue. And the way he, you know, he looked up at the Buddha statue, and then he prostrated very slowly, very mindfully, and you could tell that his mind had, that the prostration was really indicative of his inner feeling of respect and appreciation and humility, that he was really bowing to the Buddha because he saw the Buddha's qualities. And so it made me think, just watching him do three simple prostrations, how often I just go boom, 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 clunk, and sit down, you know, and how much we miss out on really the mental transformation that can come through bowing. and how important that mental transformation is. You know, because if we can make one bow with real sincerity towards the three jewels, it really transforms our mind quite a bit, you know. And it's so opposite to the mind we so often have, which is, I'm here, it's time to do this, come on, let's go, you know. I signed up for this. You better do your part and give me what I want. And let's go. And how that, that attitude that we so often have, actually it works counter purposes to what we're actually trying to do with our mind. Yeah. And it comes so often, I think, because of our consumer mentality. Yeah. I'm here. I want to get this. Yeah. Your job is to deliver it to me. And, it's time. So let's, come on already. Yeah. And that's why, there's the practice of requesting teachings three times, requesting anything three times, because it's a thing of transforming our mind. Yeah, it's not just, I'm here and I want to get what I want. So those were my reflections on watching that one monk bow. So I stopped at location 4172. I don't know what page that is, 192, but I have a mental consciousness. Yeah? Is that where we are? So to remember the context that we're in, we're talking about the selfless as the broad category of both existence and non-existence. Then among that, focusing in on existence, which has two subdivisions, functioning things, which are impermanent, and uncompounded things, which are permanent. And then among that, focusing in on functioning things, impermanent things. And there's three categories there: form, or matter, consciousness. And then the third category, I like the translation, abstract composites, but he here is using Jeffrey's translation of non-associated compositional factors, which is a mouthful. So we talked about matter or form, things that are composed by and large by atoms or some kind of small particles, although there's grosser and more subtle types of form, all the way up to, in Tantra, the extremely subtle wind energy that is the mount of the extremely subtle mind. And then with consciousness, we talked about it, the definition of being that which is clear and cognizant. So clear in the sense, two senses. One, that it's not matter. And second, that it's clear and that it can reflect objects. And then cognizant in that it can engage with objects, it can know objects. And then among the consciousnesses, in some texts, it divides it between primary consciousnesses and mental factors. This text, he divided consciousness between mental consciousness and sense consciousnesses. And so first going into mental consciousness, which is interesting because usually we start out with sense consciousnesses because they're grosser and more obvious. But anyway, okay. So here the definition of mental consciousness is a knower that has produced independence on its own uncommon empowering condition, a mental sense power. Now, I was doing a little bit of research because this topic came up about uncommon conditions and uncommon empowering conditions and then just plain old empowering conditions. And in every other book I looked at, there was no difference made between uncommon empowering conditions and common empowering conditions. And in fact, there was only one Sanskrit term and only one Tibetan term. Yeah. And also, what is translated as uncommon empowering condition, many people translate as dominant condition, with no uncommon or common or anything. So I began to wonder if his breaking it up into common or uncommon was his own way of thinking, or perhaps somebody mentioned that to him, but I didn't see it in any other source that I looked at, and the terminology certainly didn't indicate that. So, in any case, it's not a crucial issue here, so I think we can leave it aside for the moment, because the main point is that there's three conditions for consciousness. The objective condition, which is the object that's being perceived, the dominant or uncommon empowering condition, which is what enables the connection between the object and the consciousness, and then the immediately preceding condition, which is the preceding moment of any type of consciousness. Also, what I found interesting in his explanation here of talking about those three conditions for consciousness was that it's always presented in terms of direct perceivers. Yeah. Whereas it doesn't seem to be presented in terms of conceptual consciousnesses. But if you think about it, what I just described works very well for direct perceivers. But for conceptual consciousnesses, you know, the objective condition, there can be a big period of space between when the object was initially perceived by one of the sense consciousnesses and then when we remember it or think about it or conceptualize about it. That can come quite a bit later. But it doesn't seem to be discussed in this kind of context. Yeah, but it seems to me it should be in there somewhere. Okay, but maybe when we get to low rig, although I looked at one low rig text today, it didn't seem to go into that too much, but maybe we'll find one that does. Okay, so shall we start at the beginning of mental consciousness or halfway through? At the beginning? Okay. So this will just be a review, but we won't stop with all the common and uncommon and stuff, okay? So the definition of a mental consciousness is a knower that is produced in dependence on its own uncommon empowering condition, a mental sense power. So mental and sense consciousnesses are divided in terms of their special bases of dependence, their uncommon, meaning unique or unshared causes. Okay, so it could be, you know, uncommon in the sense that the eye faculty, you know, it acts to produce only a visual consciousness. It won't produce a mental consciousness or anything like that. So the uncommon empowering condition of a sense consciousness is its own internal sense power. So the eye sense power is the uncommon empowering condition for the eye consciousness or the visual consciousness. And it is just the same with the other four sense powers and our sense faculties and their respective consciousnesses. So the sense faculties, they're considered a subtle kind of matter. They're clear, and we don't seem to be able to perceive them like by seeing them or anything like that, but they're said to be a type of form. The uncommon empowering condition of a mental consciousness is the mental sense power, which is any of the six consciousnesses, and here he says, in the immediately preceding moment. So that's indicating that it's going to be a directly perceiving mental consciousness, and that the Satantrika school asserts that at the end of any series of moments of a sense consciousness, then there is one moment of a mental consciousness that directly perceives the object. But the question comes up, ordinary sentient beings can't directly perceive an object in one moment. There needs to be a series of moments. So put that in the parking lot for the questions, you know, together with all the other questions we have for things that we can't figure out. So thus, the eye consciousness of the last moment can serve as the mental sense faculty or mental sense power and uncommon empowering condition of a mental consciousness of the present moment. Okay, so it's talking about direct perceivers. We have these experiences all the time when the eye prompts a mental consciousness, but of course we're unaware of them. Moreover, as the substantial cause of the eye consciousness of the present moment, the eye consciousness of the last moment is also an empowering condition of the present eye consciousness, although not an uncommon empowering condition. But, you know, you could also have a first moment of an eye consciousness, because it isn't like our visual consciousness is functioning all day long. You know, there's times when we close our eyes and it's not functioning. And so there, you know, it would probably be the seed of the eye, of the visual consciousness, that was the substantial cause. Okay. Similarly, the eye sense power is an uncommon empowering condition of an eye consciousness. And if that eye consciousness induces a mental consciousness, the eye sense power is also an empowering condition of that mental consciousness, although it is not an uncommon one because the mental consciousness can be prompted by any of the senses. Only mental consciousnesses are produced in dependence on an uncommon empowering condition that is the mental sense power. And this is identified not as subtle matter, but as a former moment of consciousness. Okay? So when we talk of the 18 constituents, then you have four that are objects, you know, one for each sense, four that are the sense faculties, and then, six. Nobody was making faces. You should have been when I said four. Six objects, six faculties, and six consciousnesses. And that makes the 18 constituents, okay? And that includes all, those 18 include all phenomena. Then you can also synthesize the 18 into the 12 sources, okay, or the 12 ayatanas, six objects, and six dominant conditions or empowering conditions, okay? And then you say, but wait a minute, what about the consciousnesses? Yeah, we just cut those six out because we only have 12 now. Well, those six consciousnesses all fit into the mental sense faculty because the, you know, in your 12, your list of 12, so you have your six sense faculties. So the mental one, yeah, is going to include all six consciousnesses. Is that clear? Do people understand that? Okay. No, because what is the mental faculty? What constitutes the mental faculty? Look at the beginning of the section. Okay. Look at the sentence that says the uncommon empowering condition of a mental consciousness is the mental sense power or mental sense faculty, which is any of the six consciousnesses. Okay, so what constitutes the mental sense faculty? Any of the six consciousnesses. Okay, so in your list of 12, where do those six consciousnesses go? Which one are they included in? Yeah, the mental sense faculty. Okay? So that your 12 sources include the 18 constituents. Is that clear now? Do you want me to draw a picture? Okay. Imagine three columns. One column with six. Form, sound, what else? Odor. Taste, tactile, and phenomena. Okay? Then your second column is the sense faculty. That they're going to be the dominant or empowering conditions. What do you have there? Eye sense faculty, which is what? What's the eye sense faculty? The subtle material in your retina. Okay, then the second one, the ear sense faculty or ear sense power. What is that one? Subtle form inside here. Then olfactory sense faculty. What's that? Subtle form up your nose. Then gustatory sense faculty, which is, okay, your taste buds or something in your taste buds. Then tactile sense faculty, not the sensations, like the nerves, you know, in the skin, in the inside of your body, you know, that feel hunger or thirst or whatever. Then the mental sense faculty. Yeah, the mental sense power, mental sense faculty, they're synonymous. But what's inside, what's that? This, any of the six consciousnesses. Okay, so there we have the 12 sources. If you want to expand it to the 18 constituents, then in your third column, your first column was the object, the second column was the sense faculty, the third column is consciousnesses. What are you going to have under consciousnesses? What's the first one? Visual. Auditory consciousness. Olfactory consciousness. Gustatory consciousness. Do it as Jeffrey said. Tactile consciousness. And mental consciousness. Okay? So there you can see how the 12 can be expanded to the 18. Okay? Yeah. So remember this. Of course, in addition to the mind having the ability to, to image sensations, to imagine, image sensations from any of the sense consciousness, it has this amazing capacity for conceptuality, as you have noticed. Okay, so we have lots of conceptions. Some conceptions are really useful. Some conceptions are rubbish. Our problem, one of our problems, is that we can't tell the difference between the two. Yeah. And we think all of our conceptions are true and amazing and precious because they pass through our mind. That's the only reason why. So thought, conceptuality, and a thinking consciousness should all be mutually inclusive with a conceptual mental consciousness. Our typical way of thinking of the mind is that it always operates by thought. However, in this meditative tradition, the Buddhists assert that the mind, like the sense consciousnesses, is also capable of operating as a direct perceiver, knowing its objects without conceptuality. Okay, so in our normal life, when we think of our mind, one thought after another, we think that's what the mind does, just proliferating thoughts and, you know, thinking about things, planning things, remembering things, you know, everything we're doing, wondering what other people think about us, wondering if how we appear, wondering if other people like us, you know, all these kind of fantastic thoughts. Yeah, proliferations. However, the mind also has this other capacity, which is to directly perceive things. So that's knowing an object without conceptuality. In fact, the ultimate type of mental knowers are mental direct perceivers, for the Buddhists find some disadvantages with conceptuality. What do you think are the disadvantages of conceptuality? Yeah, some can be totally wrong. What, even with the correct ones, what's the disadvantage? Lack of clarity and vividness because
we don't perceive the object directly. It's the generic image that stands in the way.
Yeah, because we're perceiving the object, knowing the object, through the medium of a conceptual appearance, right? Which is merging things from different times, different places, things that are similar, forming this conceptual appearance. Okay, and then confusing sometimes the conceptual appearance with the actual object, which we can see when you're sitting there meditating and all of a sudden you think about a conversation you had with somebody and you begin to get really upset and mad at this person because you're remembering they said this and they did that. And you're getting mad at them, okay? So all of that is conceptual consciousness. And why do we get mad even though the person that we're mad at isn't anywhere nearby? They could be halfway around the world. They could be dead. Why are we getting mad at them? Yeah, because the mental image is appearing. And we're not clear what is the mental image and what is the person. Yeah. So why, you know, when you think of a loved one, yeah, you're going along your day. You're completely fine. Okay. Yeah. Then you think of somebody you really love. Yeah. Then this feeling comes up of, oh, this person, I want to be with them. I love them so much, and they're not here, and I want to be with them, and can I call them, and our lives are intertwined forever, and on and on and on, and a lot of emotion comes up, and the person isn't even there. Ever happened to you? Yeah? Person is nowhere there. And you were going along totally fine beforehand. Your mind was calm. And as soon as you had this mental appearance of this, conceptual appearance of the person, then your mind gets all stirred up. But whether you're going along just fine or your mind's all stirred up, the person isn't there. They're somewhere else.
I have noticed another similar situation with the generic images in that, for example, the image that I have of my mother is the image of a 40-year-old woman. Yeah. Well, she's now 70-something woman. Yeah. And I keep on trying to figure out why she's not acting or thinking or behaving in the same way. And I keep getting confused and frustrated and angry, and because, well, she's 72 years old, she's not who she was when she was 40, yeah. And then my mind has a hard time making that shift, so it's constantly sort of trying to, oh, yeah, that's right, she's different, so... Yeah, it's quite interesting.
Yeah, that your mental image of the person is very far removed mm-hmm. from what the person is now.
Right. Same thing with Adriana. In my mind, she's 10 years old. And I relate to her as 10 years old. But no, that's okay because before coming to the Abbey, she was 5. Now she's upgraded to 10. Now she's upgraded to 10. Maybe 5 years from now, she'll be, what, 12, 13? So yeah. It's like that's...
But in actual time, she's 22?
Yeah, she's 22, exactly. Yeah. That's the problem. So I keep, this is my image, and therefore I relate to her in that sense, as if she were at that age, and she's not.
She's not. Yeah. So our mind is really tricking us, isn't it?
What I find interesting is that it's almost expected that, like, this is an okay thing to do. Like, you pine for your loved one or you daydream and then you allow yourself to get worked up, and that's just normal and part of romance or, like, this conceptuality that gets us
yeah,
off
it
into
makes
nowhere.
You happy. Yeah. Oh,
fleetingly.
Yeah. Don't the afflictions really condition these concepts? Like, they're always... Well, not always, but often distorted by the afflictions?
The concepts yeah. create the afflictions.
But the concepts, like, say we're in love with someone, when we think about them, we exaggerate all their good qualities. So this is the concept that's...
Yeah, and uh-huh. that produces the attachment.
So the concept itself is kind of neutral?
No, the concept is distorted.
Mm-hmm, it's distorted.
Yeah, but we're really believing in this concept, and then attachment, anger, whatever emotion mm-hmm. comes as a result of reacting to it. Like she's saying, she imagines her daughter, you know, this 10-year-old child who doesn't know how to do things and needs mama's protection. Yeah, and having that image in her mind, then what surges up is, I'm the mother who's going to protect my child, and I'm attached to my child, and she needs me. And so you have the conception, then you have the mm-hmm. affliction, which is also conceptual, arises.
So the concept is distorted by ignorance, and then it's
distorted. Remember, we talked about the four distortions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So by any one or more of those. Yeah. In the case, not all concepts are distorted, but by all four, okay? But in the case when an affliction arises, you definitely have a lot of distortion in the concept. So that's why... When you talk about working with anger, one of the biggest things that we have to realize is when we have anger, we are not seeing the object correctly. And when attachment is there, we are not seeing the object correctly. And when jealousy is there, we're not seeing the object correctly. You know, when any of the afflictions are there, the mind is not seeing the object correctly. Yeah, of course we think we are.
As more afflictions you have, as more conceptions you have?
No, usually the more conceptions you have, the more afflictions you have.
Oh, yeah.
This is the thing, the conceptions really come first, and then they feed into the arisal of the afflictions. Because remember, when we traced out the arisal of afflictions, you have the ignorance grasping true existence. Then you have that mental factor that we were translating as inappropriate attention, but we changed it to distorted conception. And then that gives rise to the afflictions. Okay? So watch the process in your mind. Yeah, because if you are, that's what I was talking about at the BBC at lunch today. If we're able to look at the conceptions that lie behind the afflictions and see that they are exaggerated and have nothing to do with the actual object or situation, then the affliction doesn't arise. So we've taken away that distorted conception or inappropriate attention.
Because it seems when I have an affliction, more conceptions arise. So my mind is even starting more to think and, you know, yeah, in all kinds of ways.
Right. So when we have the conception, the emotion arises, then we ruminate. Yeah? This person did that, you know, the emotion, anger arises. Then we go back. Oh, they said this to me. Then they said that. Then they said this. This is what is their motivation is. I know they intentionally want to hurt me. They're the scum of the earth, you know. And me, I'm a victim. Everybody always treats me. So we have that emotion, and then we ruminate, and more conceptual comes. So the emotion gets stronger and stronger. Okay. And then we're just exploding fireworks, you know?
Yeah. Conceptions, are these also habituated?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you can have more conceptions as more as you're letting your mind widely go this path.
Yeah. Okay. The more you let the mind just ruminate and go over the situation again and again, the more conceptions you have. And when we start looking at our conceptions, here's where we start seeing mental patterns and emotional patterns, you know? And so some people, for example, the lens through which their conception goes is a lens of safety. I'm not safe in this situation. I'm suspicious of these people. These people could harm me. Another person, you know, their lens, and so the conceptions they go around with is, I'm an individual. I don't want to be part of this group. Okay. And another person's conceptions could be, people are going to take advantage of me. Okay, so every, you know, and another person's conception is, I've got to be best. So, you know, we have these habitual conceptions. You know, we talk about this a lot, about just habitual ways of, we see the world, and so habitual emotions that arise. So this is what's going on here. Yeah. Why am I always uncomfortable when I meet people? Because I have this habitual conception that arises whenever I meet new people of, they're out to get me. Or whatever it is, you know. So we have gazillions of these kinds of things. And some of them, they're just, you know, like push button. Yeah, and so we can see it in our habitual emotional responses to things. Yeah. Okay, is this making some sense to people? And is this, are you seeing an avenue of how to untie all of this? Yeah. Yeah. There's a way to untie it all. You can do it. Yeah. See, that's the conception, the habitual conception. This is too hard. Yeah, I can't do it. This is too hard. Okay? That's not the reality of the situation. That's just a habitual thought that, it, you know, we think again and again whenever something comes up. it's too hard, I can't do it, so I'm not even going to try. Yeah. And so you see how those habitual thoughts, when they go unquestioned, how they trap us and they limit us. Yeah. And they destroy our self-confidence. Yes, writing the syllogisms is very helpful for untangling it. Yeah. Because you write out your syllogisms and they're so ridiculous that you have to laugh.
Well, I want to stick up for conceptions because, as you mentioned earlier, I mean, granted, most of ours are erroneous because they have been fed by our habituation and the distorted attention. Mm-hmm. But also, when we meditate, do analytic meditation, that's conception.
That's all
too.
Conception,
so
right?
So to say that conceptions are the cause of afflictions, I wonder, would we have to say distorted conceptions or
we have
erroneous
to say
conceptions?
It's very clear it's distorted conception. Because clearly when you're learning about emptiness and thinking about emptiness, that's not going to produce affliction, hopefully, unless you say it's too hard, I can't do it. Yeah. But it's conceptions we eventually want to go beyond, but we need them in order to learn. I mean, most of our education is learning terms and language and concepts. Yeah, so it does, definitely it has a function. But we were just talking about the distorted ones. Okay? Waving the flag of conception.
All right. What is, you said your term you're using for inappropriate attention is distorted conception or distorted?
Yeah, yes. It's the Tibetan term is sulmanice. Or what's the Sanskrit? Manasikara. No, something manasikara, something like that. Yeah. But sulmanice is.
It was a related point to what Venerable Tsepo said in that. I was experimenting with changing these conceptions. Mm-hmm. And because I had this conception, very negative conception about a person, mm-hmm. which I had built, I realized, for many years, 10, 15 years, built this negative conception. And I wanted to change it because I realized how damaging it was. And so I decided to change it by purposefully sitting down and tearing it down. Thinking, finding examples of the opposite, mm-hmm. you know, when the person was kind.
Yeah.
And it so happened that as I was thinking about moments of kindness, my mind would go, oh, no, but how about this and that and this and that and this and that? So I would spend like 1 second thinking of the kindness, and in this 5 minutes, all the stuff that I had built in would come in.
Yeah.
And I had to go, I start from, when I was way into the reminiscing of the bad stuff, then I would have to stop, oh, wait a minute, I went back to the same path. I have to come back, let's think about something else that was kind. And then the whole thing would repeat again. So I had to, so it's basically, we're using the same process that we used to build all the negative stuff, mm-hmm. but now I'm trying to use it to build the positive stuff to counteract. And it takes time to undo the work of the 15 whatever how many years. but it is possible.
Yes.
Because I have noticed a change in my attitude towards that person.
Yeah.
And it's because of that type of work.
Right. So. Right. And that's what real Dharma practice is. Is, you know, you saw that you had an incorrect way of thinking and that made affliction arise. And then you deliberately, consciously worked at changing that way of thinking. Okay? So that you would change your response, your emotional response.
Right. And so the way that this is related to what Venerable Tsepo said is that we can use conceptuality as well in a different way to counter all the garbage that we put in our mind.
Right. And when we're using thought training or Lamrim meditation, that's exactly what we're doing. Okay? So, for example, you're angry because somebody did something to you, and then you sit and you think, this is a result of my own karma, of my actions in the past. And so you think about karma. You think about how you, you know, could have behaved or must have behaved in the past. And so you, by thinking about that, that's all conceptual process. You're familiarizing your mind with a different perspective that is contrary to the habitual one of, you know, look what they did to me. Okay? Yeah. So that's why, you know, when we're learning Lam Rim and Lojong, when we, you know, we do those checking meditations repeatedly so that those new concepts, those new perspectives become implanted in our mind because we're creating a new habit. Yeah. We're creating new habits with our mind. Yeah. And so we can't just wait for the moment when somebody tells us off to think of the, you know, the Lojong, the mind training remedy. We have to think about it in our meditation, get familiar with it. Yeah. The more familiar we are with it, the less we can be triggered by other people's actions. And then even if we are triggered, the more familiar we are with it, the easier we can remember that other perspective and shift our mind towards it and counteract the affliction. Okay, so this is what Dharma practice means. Yeah, it's not ringing bells and playing drums and, you know, looking holy and all that kind of stuff. It's this nitty gritty working with the mind.
When you were talking today, at, I think it was the lunch BBC, what you're also saying is that until you work that out, you'll never be able to really develop serenity.
Yeah.
Because you just would get, you know, you just could be distracted.
Yeah. You'll be distracted, or even if you succeed in somewhat suppressing the afflictions, when you come out of your meditation, they're all there. Yeah. And then they affect you in your daily life.
Based on what Venerable Tarpa just said, how do you know when you're ready to start developing serenity?
It's not like when you're ready, you do a little bit of it in your practice, you know, regularly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you focus more on learning how to identify afflictions and how to counteract them because you need that skill to generate serenity. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, you can think of, well, the story they like to tell, the Tibetans, is of this meditator who, you know, was in deep samadhi and his beard grew out and some mice nested in his beard. And when he woke up from his samadhi and he saw the mice nesting in his beard, he freaked out. Yeah. So, you know, or the other meditator who, you know, had blissful samadhi and then went down to town and somebody insulted him and he exploded. Yeah. Or a person I know who did years of retreat of shamatha meditation and then when she finished the retreat decided to go back to school and being back in school, then she wanted to return her precept about taking intoxicants. And I thought, wow, you do years and years of meditation, and the conclusion is that you don't want to keep your intoxicant precept. Yeah. So, anyway, shall we go on? We haven't gotten very far, have we? Okay. In fact, the ultimate type of mental knowers are mental direct perceivers for the Buddhists find some disadvantages with conceptuality. However, they do not showcase mental direct perceivers as always extraordinary ultimate knowers. For existence, they say that a sense consciousness might be engaged in observing something within its field of operation, such as an eye consciousness noticing the color of a blue sky. And then the eye consciousness prompts the mind, after which there is a moment of mental direct perception of the blue sky. And then the mind slips into the thought of a blue sky. Okay, so that mental moment of mental direct perception of the blue sky is nothing special. Yeah, okay, we want to have mental direct perceptions of impermanence, emptiness, you know, things that are really going to transform our mind. Okay, now the next section is about sense consciousnesses. So I also want to say, sometimes in the terminology, we hear mental sense faculty. That's very confusing because, you know, we talk about six senses sometimes, and sometimes we talk about five senses, and we usually think five senses. So when we hear mental sense faculty, we get confused about what it is. So sometimes just saying mental faculty is easier. It gets us out of that rut of thinking that it's got to be a sense faculty like our regular sense consciousnesses correspond with. Okay. So sense consciousnesses, and here you can see when he says sense consciousness, he's not including mental. Okay? So sense consciousnesses are produced in dependence on their own uncommon empowering conditions, which are physical sense powers, not mental sense powers, or mental power. Okay, physical sense powers or physical sense faculties, such as the eye sense faculty. The definition of a sense consciousness is a knower that is produced in dependence on its own uncommon empowering condition, a physical sense faculty or power. So there's five types of sense consciousnesses. Visual consciousness, they always put it, you know, eye, ear, kind of corresponding with the physical organ. But I like to use visual consciousness and auditory, olfactory, gustatory, tactile. Okay? And so we're going through the definitions of these. So the definition of an eye consciousness is a knower that is produced in dependence on its own uncommon empowering condition, the eye sense faculty, and an observed object condition, a visible form. Okay, so there you have it. As mentioned above, in regard to internal forms, there are three essentials required for a sense perception. One, these are an external form, such as a visible form, a sound, an odor, and so on, which serves as the object of perception. Two, internal matter, one of the sense faculties. And three, the continuum of the sense consciousness. I think it's the continuum of any consciousness. Yeah, but that's what we've heard, what I found in the other sources. In this context, external forms are observed object conditions for the five sense consciousnesses. Colors and shape for the eye consciousness, sounds for the ear consciousness, and so on. A condition is a cause, and a form is a condition for a sense consciousness, because partially in dependence on the appearance of such a material object, a consciousness observing that material object is produced. Okay, so when you see something, you need an object. You need the functioning of your eye faculty. And you need an immediately preceding consciousness. Okay? If there's no object, you're not going to have a visual consciousness. If your eye faculty isn't working properly, no conscious, you're not going to be able to see anything. If you're dead and there's no immediately preceding consciousness, forget it. Okay? Thus, Buddhists put forth a view that that consciousness is a different entity from matter, and though it interacts with matter, it is not matter, and it does not have matter as its substantial cause. So matter, material things, is never the substantial cause for a consciousness. It can be a condition that makes a consciousness arise, but it never is the thing that transforms into the consciousness itself. Why? Because material things and consciousnesses have two different natures. Material things are atomic. They can be noticed by the sense consciousnesses. The mind is immaterial. Okay, it is that which is clear and knowing. And so matter alone, the sense faculties alone, cannot perceive things, except the vaivasikas think they can, but we'll ignore them. You have to have, it's the consciousness that perceives things. And so that's really the difference between a live person and a corpse, the presence or the absence of consciousness. Yeah, because you could have the form there, you could have the brain functioning or whatever, or the heart beating or the respiration going on, but unless there's consciousness there, there's no sentient experience. There's no sentient being. Yeah, so, you know, all the work they're doing with chirogenics, freezing the body or freezing the head or whatever, useless. Yeah. Unless somebody's created the karma to be a spirit that then is born inside of just a head. Oh, goodness. Yeah. Can you imagine working in a chirogenics and a head starts talking to you because a spirit occupied it? Okay. Yeah, not my career choice. We can all see there's plenty of matter lying about, and given the right conditions, like proximity and light, we can perceive it. The individual sense powers give the five individual sense consciousnesses power to perceive their appropriate external objects. The sense consciousnesses is then generated in the aspect of the object and a sense perception occurs. Okay? So when they talk about the sense, the object is generated, or the sense consciousness is generated in the aspect of the object. Okay? His Holiness likes to say, oh, it's kind of like scientists say that when, you know, your visual consciousness is perceiving something, you have like a reflection or an aspect of the object on your retina. Remember from fourth grade and it's upside down? Yeah. So it's some kind of aspect like that. Whenever you hear the word aspect or factor, it means it's something, but you're not going to get a clear definition. At least that's my experience. No, that's okay. The remaining sense consciousnesses are defined similarly in relation to their own special sense powers and the objects that they are empowered to perceive. So, you know, to be very clear, you know, a visual consciousness cannot apprehend a sound. Yeah. A smell cannot be apprehended by an auditory consciousness. So these things are they all correspond with their own thing. Okay, so the definition of an auditory consciousness is a knower that has produced independence on its own uncommon empowering condition, the ear sense faculty, and an observed object condition, a sound. Okay, so what's the definition of an olfactory consciousness going to be? A knower.
It's produced independence
in the
sound. Uncommon.
The olfactory sense power and an observed object condition, an odor. Okay. So what about the definition of a tongue consciousness? Tongue consciousness. That's why I say, gustatory consciousness. Yeah, like I say tongue consciousness, I imagine somebody sticking out their tongue and then it's being, you know, alive or something. Okay, so what's the definition of a gustatory consciousness going to be? A knower that has produced independence on its own uncommon condition. A gustatory sense power or sense faculty and object condition, a taste, such as, now bread isn't a taste, salty or sweet or bitter. Yeah. Then, definition of body consciousness, tactile consciousness, a knower. That is produced independence upon common occurring condition, tactile our sense, okay, and an object condition, a tangible object such as rough, smooth, hard, hunger, thirst, cold, hot. Within Buddhism, there is great emphasis on the study and training of consciousness. Yeah. Why? Why does Buddhism emphasize the study and training of consciousness so much? It's more powerful. That's what's going to get transformed into a Buddha. And it's what experiences pain and pleasure. And it's what wants to be happy. Yeah, it's what we work with. Okay, if there were no consciousness, there would be absolutely no reason to follow the path. Because there would be nothing wanting happiness and to abandon suffering. And there would nothing that would be able to perceive anything that is being taught. And in fact, there would be nothing being taught because you have to have a consciousness for something to be taught. You know, books don't appear out of nowhere. Okay? So this is, you know, the reason I stopped here and like, okay, let's think about why is the consciousness so important? Is because in our society, our attention is always on the material world and always on the body. Okay? And why do we pay attention to the material world and the body? Because they are objects of consciousness and they cause pleasure or pain. So it's because consciousness exists that we pay attention to all these external things. But are the external things really the cause of happiness? Yeah. Is it your neurons that experience happiness? Is it your dopamine that feels satisfied? Yeah. Can you have a Petri dish with a whole bunch of brain cells in it? And do they feel anything? Yeah. So You know, we have to be so clear. This is why we put so much attention on the consciousness. Yeah, because without consciousness, we wouldn't even have objects to perceive. Because remember, what's the definition of an existent? Something that's observed by consciousness, by a valid cognizer. Okay? So everything exists in relationship to the mind. The mind is really foremost. So going through our lives, always fixated on the body, always fixated on the external world, we're missing the point. Yeah? We're missing the point. His Holiness brought this up during the teachings, you know, last week. Yeah, we're talking about you paying attention to external objects, being a waste of time. So if you want other kitties to like you, you got to change your behavior. If you want to get along with other kitties, I don't know where she hid, you have to change the way you think. We should really do a book on what we learned from the animals at the Abbey. Because, I mean, they're a whole Dharma teaching in themselves, aren't they?
But we can't see it ourselves.
Yeah. We can see so clearly in them, but not in ourselves. Okay, so within Buddhism, there's great emphasis on the study and training of consciousness. Buddhism presents a view of self-creation, that one's own actions create one's life's situation. In this light, it has been said that Buddhism is not a religion, but a science of mind. That's a quote from His Holiness. Self-creation here means that we create our own experience through how our mind operates. In Buddhism, the emphasis on study is especially directed at developing wisdom, which is ultimately able to liberate. It is fulfilled in the realization of selflessness, but begins with awareness and mindfulness of impermanence and ordinary appearances. The place of epistemology in this process is to establish which consciousnesses are reliable and which are not. That is, which can yield knowledge and which cannot. So that's what we were just talking about earlier. You know, our conceptualizations, which can yield knowledge, which are in line with reality and which aren't. This topic will be explored in Chapter 12, Consciousness in Relation to What They Perceive. The other parts of self-creation that the Dalai Lama refers to in the quote above have to do with morality and heart. These begin with overcoming selfishness and developing helpful attitudes such as love and compassion. Okay, non-associated compositional factors, also called abstract composites. The third group of functioning things are non-associated compositional factors. 13 syllables. Abstract composites. 5 syllables. I can, you know, I have my editor's head behind me, you know. Make it simple. Okay, so the definition may be put as a functioning thing that is neither a form nor a consciousness. Okay, all impermanent phenomena that are neither matter nor consciousnesses are included among non-associated compositional factors. They are called compositional factors because of being factors that allow for the aggregation of causes and conditions and for the production, abiding, and cessation of products. I would take issues with this. I don't think that they're factors that allow for the aggregation of causes and conditions. They are things that are arise due to causes and conditions and are composed of parts. Okay, they don't, I mean, a person, does a person allow for the aggregation of causes and conditions? That sounds strange, doesn't it? Does area allow for the, yeah, so I would talk about it a little bit differently there. They are non-associated because, unlike minds, they are not associated with minds or mental factors. Non-associated compositional factors, so they're not associated because they're not matter and they're not consciousness, okay? So they're the grab bag of everything that is neither of those. Non-associated compositional factors are of two types, okay? Abstract composites that are persons and abstract composites that are not persons. Now it's going to get real interesting. A person, so non-associated compositional factors that are persons. Do you think of yourself as, I'm a non-associated compositional factor? How about I'm a abstract composite? No. I'm me. Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, what are we really in this whole thing? Yeah. Oh, I'm an abstract composite. Big deal. Yeah, but I want to be a big deal. I want to be more than an abstract composite or a non-associated compositional factor. Yeah? And you? Do you want to be bigger than that? A person is a non-associated compositional factor because of being an impermanent phenomena that is neither a form nor a consciousness. Okay, this means that you are not your body and you are not your mind. Now think about that. You know, how often during the day do we think, I am my body or I am my mind? Yeah, we identify with our body and mind very often. And when we don't, what shows that we are not our body and mind is when we don't think I am my body, then we think my body is my possession. My mind is my possession. So sometimes we think we're the body or mind, and sometimes we regard the body and mind as a possession. Okay? But we're not our body and mind. And where is the owner that possesses this body and mind? Me! I'm here! Right here! I exist! I possess the body and mind. I am this thing that never gets destroyed, that exists from its own side, that continues on into infinity, and that should be able to control everybody and everything. Yeah? I am not something that is merely imputed in dependence on a body and mind. I am more than that. Don't just tell me I'm an abstract composite. Don't tell me. Like the next sentence, rather, persons are imputed to a collection of form and consciousness, the body and mind. Are you kidding? I'm not merely imputed to the collection of body and mind. I mean, do you feel like you're merely imputed to the collection of the body and mind or independence on your body and mind? You know, what's your gut feeling every day? I'm not imputed. I am here. I am the most real thing in the universe. Yeah. If any, you know, the building is imputed because I can see it has many parts. Yeah. The computer's imputed. I can see it has causes and conditions. So the tree has causes and conditions too. Yeah, these things are all imputed. But me? Forget it. I am the solid thing here running the show. Most important thing in the entire universe. Independent, always correct. Except when I make mistakes. But my mistakes aren't real mistakes. Or if they are real mistakes, it's because I am fundamentally horrible. The most... I am more horrible than you. You're just an imputed phenomena. I am inherently horrible. Yeah, hopeless. Okay? I mean, when you read these definitions and then you compare them with what your gut feeling is, there's a difference, isn't there? Yeah? So somehow our gut feeling is out of tune, out of sync. So this means that you are not your body and you are not your mind. Rather, persons are imputed to a collection of form and consciousness, the body and mind. Prasangikas would say persons are imputed independence on a collection of form and consciousness, the body and mind. Not to, but independence on. Okay. Since a person is neither form nor consciousness, but impermanent, it can only be an instance of the remaining category of impermanent phenomena, an non-associated compositional factor. You mean I'm a non-associated compositional factor? What kind of lowly status, insignificant thing is that? You know, I'm a factor, I'm compositional, and I'm non-associated. What a put-down. You know, you just shut up, you non-associated compositional. Can you imagine one of Trump's tweets, you know, kind of criticizing, who's he criticizing? Oh, Bob Woodward this week. Bob Woodward, you non-associated compositional fact. Oh. It sounds good. It sounds insulting, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah? What an insult. Okay. Because the person is a collection, a gathering, or a grouping. No, the person is not the collection. See, he's worded it incorrectly here. You cannot say the person is a collection, a gathering, or a grouping of matter and consciousness. The person is imputed independence on the collection of or grouping of matter and consciousness. It is not the collection. Because remember when we're, you know, checking for the existence of the object of negation, we refute that it's the collection of the parts. Okay? Because the person is, okay, the person is not matter alone, nor consciousness alone. You're right. I am not matter and I am not consciousness. I am the supreme whatever, me. Yeah, that's the way we feel. Imagine that you have a pile of square things and round things. You cannot say that the pile is a collection of round things, and you cannot say that it is a collection of square things. So the person is defined as a being who is imputed independence upon any of the five aggregates. Now, I've heard that definition a bit differently. Being a person, a being who is imputed independence upon the collection of the five aggregates, or imputed upon the five aggregates. We can identify a person by seeing any of the five aggregates. We don't need to contact all of them. But the basis of designation of the person has to be all five aggregates, unless you're in the formless realm, and then you don't have a physical aggregate. There's only four aggregates. Okay. So the basis of designation, you have to have all five aggregates, but you can identify a person based on just one of them. You see their body, or you don't even have to see their whole body. You see their ear. Okay. Maybe you know, it gets sticky. Can you impute a person on the basis of an ear? Yeah. Or maybe it's, you know, the basis of designation, and what you impute the person upon is different. But the basis of designation is all five aggregates. But you can identify the person through one of them. And this, I wonder this if this is unique to Satantrika. I don't know. Anyway, again, he says a person is imputed to a collection of the basis of body and mind. It's always imputed independence on. But again, maybe Satantrikas would say imputed to. Okay. Imputed means attributed or ascribed. Okay, so designated. Just by encountering some small measure of a person's aggregates, we will impute, attribute, ascribe, or project that the person is there based on that evidence. Well, but you may be wrong. Because you can see an ear and impute the person is there, but you're perceiving the corpse.
I think it's often wrong because, for example, after my mother died, when I was in a crowd, like, you know, a store or something, mm-hmm. and I would see an attribute that was like the same color of hair or something, and my mind would say, oh, mom. And of course it wasn't, but, yeah. you know, it was like I was searching for, and it was totally wrong, yeah. totally wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, we can definitely identify things incorrectly. Okay. Upon meeting with any of the aggregates of a person, like seeing the person's face or hearing his or her voice, we impute the presence of the person. So, yes, imputing the presence of the person we can do based on part of the person. Mm-hmm. But imputing... that doesn't mean that that's the basis of designation of the person. For instance, coming home, you hear your mother's voice from the front door, and you know she is there. When you see the color and shape of a friend's face, you think, I see my friend. You do not need to contact all of the mental and physical aggregates of the person before being able to project the presence of a person, or I would say to identify the person, yeah? Thus, the definition specifies that a person is being imputed independence on any of the five aggregates. Yeah, again, like I say, I have a bit of difficulty with that.
So I'm getting a little bit confused, but aren't the five aggregates form, feeling,
yeah.
compositional factors? So some of the aggregates, you wouldn't be able to identify somebody by a feeling,
yeah,
or a discernment,
right? If you had super knowledges and could read other people's minds, then you could identify a person based on their feelings or whatever. We usually use the body or the voice because we're gross beings, and that's what we physically come into contact with. And then we identify a person based on that.
But as it's describing the voice and the face and stuff, and then it says the five aggregates, it's really confusing because you think it's actually attributing it to the five senses, hearing, smelling somebody, you know.
You can identify somebody by smelling them.
Or touching
them. Or touching them, or the cats do it by licking you. Yeah. No, that's just our senses by which we use to identify. But the base which we're identifying
is all the other parts. The race discrimination.
Right. But we can't know all the other parts with our physical senses.
Correct to say that the voice is one of the aggregates? It's not even a part of the form.
Yeah, it's part of form.
It is?
Yeah, part of the form aggregate. Isn't sound part of the form aggregate?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
The question is sound part of the body?
Right, that's the question.
Yeah, is sound part of the body? The body makes a sound.
Right.
But here, I mean, we usually say form, aggregate, and body are synonymous, but it is confusing a bit because someone's voice isn't actually their body. It's the form aggregate.
I think we're conflating the two ways that we use the five aggregates. Sometimes we say it just to be the body and mind, and sometimes we say it to be all phenomena.
All impermanent phenomena.
All impermanent phenomena.
Yeah.
So we're kind of like, you're going back and forth, and then it doesn't quite work.
Right. And sometimes when they say the form aggregate, they mean the body, and sometimes they mean all five kinds of physical objects. Yeah. So it depends on the situation. Because when you say the person is imputed independence upon the five aggregates, there the form aggregate has to be the body. Yeah, it can't be, you know, include the staircase or something like that, even though the staircase is part of the general larger form. It's a confusion of language, you know, how Tibetan works. Okay, so what are the five aggregates? The story goes that the Buddha explained these bases of the person by sitting on a riverbank. He piled up five clumps or heaps of sand and described the bases to which we attribute the person. The Sanskrit word he used for these piles was skanda. Evidently, this is the basis for the English word candy, for candy was first made with bits of molasses, boiled sugar cane juice, clumped together. Valuable piece of information. The five skandhas, or the five aggregates, are the bases to which persons are imputed. Independence upon the five skandhas, the person is imputed. Moreover, the five aggregates include all impermanent phenomena. That's when you're talking about in general. In the Gomong collected topics, functioning things are divided into the five aggregates rather than into the three listed in this chapter, which were form, consciousness, and non-associated compositional factors. Okay, so five aggregates, form, feeling, discriminations, compositional factors, which Geshe-la renamed miscellaneous factors. And I think Geshe-dado. You know, and I like that much better because they are. The miscellaneous is just, it's a grab bag of everything that doesn't fit into the other four. And then the fifth is consciousnesses, meaning primary consciousness.
Can you, I understand that you're making the distinction imputed independence on and as opposed to imputed to. Mm-hmm. Can you flesh that out a bit for me, why it's so important?
Okay. Just saying it's imputed to makes it sound like this collection is some solid thing, and then you're just pasting a label on top of it. Yeah. Whereas imputed independence upon indicates that it is not those things. It's imputed independence upon them, but it is not them. Yeah, so that way of thinking is much more helpful for understanding emptiness.
So does this school, the sutra school, following reason, right? Mm-hmm. Do they say that things can be mentally directly perceived? Because they say that the selflessness is inferential.
Yeah, Right. No, they say selflessness cannot be directly perceived. Okay. But subtle impermanence can be. The reason why the Sutra School says that selflessness can't be directly perceived is because they say that what is being directly perceived is the aggregates, and what is implicitly known is that they are not the person. But for them, they don't say that a non-affirming negative can be directly perceived because it's a negation. Whereas the Prasangikas say you can directly perceive with the mental consciousness a non-affirming negation. Yeah, so that's a big difference between the tenet systems. Very big.
So I guess the reason this was coming to mind is because it says, in fact, the ultimate type of mental knowers are mental direct perceivers for the Buddhists.
Right.
And I just didn't know if that applied to this school.
Yeah, it applies to this school, but it's an ultimate direct knower that doesn't know its object. It knows its object implicitly, not explicitly. Yeah. Yeah, it's a different way of thinking. I remember during one of the Mind and Life consciousnesses, His Holiness asked Sharon Salzberg, she was there, if this is the way, you know, in her tradition that they think. And she said, yeah, you directly perceive the aggregates and implicitly know that they are not the person.